Good day and welcome to this edition of Focus on WCPI. WCPI 91.3 is the independent, non-profit, non-partisan, and non-sectarian broadcasting service of the Warren County Education Foundation, an IRS 501c3 entity, here to serve you with news and informed analysis and content. Today we're taking up a subject that has truly seized the attention of much of the world, and not just the Christian world, not just the church-going world, but people all over our planet. And that is what appears to be a fresh new pontificate, a very signal change from the way some of the popes have proceeded in the past. Pope Francis, formerly Jorge Bergoglio, bishop and cardinal from South America, just elected to the papacy by the conclave of cardinals in the winter of 2013, and in just a very brief period of time has set some, what I would have to say, some very bold new directions in the church, not so much changing the doctrines of the church, but changing the approaches that he wants his priests and church leaders to take. In my opinion, the foremost expert on Pope Francis that is available to us in Middle Tennessee is Dr. Bruce T. Morrill. Dr. Morrill, Father Morrill, is a Jesuit, a practicing Jesuit priest who keeps up a very busy schedule in pastoral duties, and I'll talk a little more about that later. But he is also the Molloy Chair of Theological Studies at Vanderbilt University's Divinity School. Father Morrill, so good to have you here, and we're honored that you would take this time to be with us.
Certainly my pleasure, Bill.
And thank you. When this program is on the air on WCPI, it will have been a week since Father Morrill was speaker at McMinnville Noon Rotary. Let's start off with a little bit about your background, Dr. Morrill. Where did you come from, and how did you wind up at Vanderbilt University?
I grew up in northeastern Maine, and was born back in 1959, so I'm pushing into my 57th year. Grew up, interestingly, I think, in a family of a couple of World War II veterans. My mom was a nurse. My dad was a supply corps. She was Russian Orthodox. My dad was Catholic. Mm-hmm. So I've always lived in a world where Christians of different churches are right together. Graduated high school and ended up going to college in Massachusetts at a Jesuit institution, Holy Cross, College of the Holy Cross, liberal arts college. And a year after graduating, entered the Society of Jesus, which is the formal name of the religious order commonly called the Jesuits. That's almost 35 years, and we have a very long formation in the process. I got my PhD in theological studies from Emory University in Atlanta, during which period also I was ordained to the priesthood. After getting the doctorate, I moved up to Massachusetts, where I taught for 15 years at Boston College, another Jesuit institution, teaching undergrads and eventually directing the doctoral program in theology. In 2011, Vanderbilt University offered me the Molloy Chair in Catholic Studies, and I was happy to accept it and face a new environment and a new set of challenges, and I'm just completing my fifth year now at Vanderbilt Divinity.
Boston College, like Vanderbilt, is a very prestigious, very highly respected institution of higher learning. How would you compare and contrast the two? Boston College and then Nashville's Vanderbilt?
Oh, that's a great question. I should just bracket it in that at the Divinity School now, I don't teach undergraduates, whereas at Boston College, a lot of my work was with the undergrads, so I feel like I don't have quite as much exposure to the ground level there. But I would say there's, first of all, a lot of similarity in terms of how highly selective and national these schools have become, increasingly international. I suppose one of the real contrasts on the two campuses would be the overtly and strongly Catholic identity of Boston College, contrasting with Vanderbilt, which is a non-sectarian private higher education institution. Boston College is in the ACC and struggles there a bit, I think, at this point because of their academic standards over against some of the other schools maybe, and that might be a similarity with some of the struggles that Vandy faces in the SEC too. They're good problems to have.
I'll hold back on this. I was going to ask you about Vanderbilt's change out of the women's basketball coach, but that's strictly optional. You can comment on that.
I'll pass on that one.
Okay. The Society of Jesus, a very ancient institution, a congregation within the Roman Catholic Church, was started some centuries ago. Ignatius Loyola started, was a nobleman, fighter. As I remember the story, he was wounded in combat and had sort of a deep spiritual experience as a result of it. So how did the Jesuits get started? And just as importantly, how did you get interested in being in the Society of Jesus?
Yes, Ignatius was basically a soldier of fortune in the early 16th century, the 1500s, of a noble family, but a financially strapped noble family. Mm-hmm. And so he was hired out to fight for other noblemen, was indeed severely wounded, and during a long convalescence ended up reading the only materials that the sisters in the hospital had, A Life of Christ and A Life of the Saints. And his imagination got captured with their heroic lives, and he decided that that was how he wanted to redirect his heroism. And there began for him a period of several years of sort of deep introspective prayer, which led him to go study at the University of Paris so he might be sufficiently educated to become a priest. In that process, formed a band of friends, and the Society of Jesus began in the middle 1500s. From a group of seven, by the time Ignatius finished as its leader, some dozen or more year later, they were already in the thousands, like 1,200 men, and quickly became important in the development of entirely new and different types of school systems. We're kind of famous for being educators as well as missionaries. Mm-hmm. And so to move to my story, with your gracious question, Bill, I was a public school kid up in northeastern Maine who decided I wanted to get the liberal arts education, bachelor's degree, fell in love with Holy Cross when I went and visited it, and the Jesuits there in the late 70s, early 80s, there were strongly 30 or 40 Jesuit professors, administrators, and over those 4 years, literally, we joined such organizations usually because of the real-life people you meet, and they inspired me. And I've never really regretted it. I wasn't quite sure to say I wanted to be a Jesuit when I was a senior in college as the idea emerged, so I was a lay volunteer for a year in Alaska, in Western Alaska, and over that year discerned, asked, and was allowed to enter. So my story of being a Jesuit really was meeting the Jesuits by attending one of our own undergraduate schools. Yeah.
What would you say, just very briefly, and then we want to get on to talking about Pope Francis, what would you say are the core values of the Society of Jesus?
Yes, the core values, well, we really want to be men, the way we've put it in the last several decades, we want to be men who serve the faith and promote justice. It's a very contemporary translation of a very different, florid kind of late medieval language Ignatius would have used, and that would have been to save souls. Well, what do you mean by that? Saving, well, that has to do really with the health and the well-being and the flourishing of people. And that, for us, is both spiritual and practical, worldly. And therefore, for us, it's not just about individuals. It's also for how we live in common, how we live a common life in a society. And so education has been such an important part of our work because it's so crucial, really, to the advancement of individuals and communities. And I would say that would probably best characterize us. Our other renewal in these recent decades has been to do this work explicitly and practically with people that are poor, whether they're suffering financial privation or any other forms of social privation, that for us, even though, and it was true for Ignatius, connections are made and remain very much with leaders in society, mm-hmm. educating the leadership class of society. On the other hand, extremely important for us that we be with the least powerful also, and try to let both of those and everything in between, those kinds of people, form greater bonds and mutual service. Mm.
If you're just now joining us, I'm having a delightful conversation with Father Bruce T. Morrill, PhD, and a member of the Society of Jesus. Father Morrill is the Molloy Chair, Professor of Catholic Studies at the Divinity School at Vanderbilt University, and certainly appreciate you taking this time. We were talking about the Society of Jesus and the idea of promoting justice. In Latin America, the Catholic Church in Latin America was sort of the incubator, the greenhouse where the idea of promoting the social gospel or social justice really took hold. And I can't help but think that it was an opportunity-rich environment because of the extreme poverty and the extreme inequality in wealth. Mm-hmm. And this is the environment in which priest Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio arose.
That's exactly right. Yes.
So what, you know, he'd worked in the barrios, he'd worked among the weakest, the poorest, the most vulnerable people on the planet Earth. How is this informing and setting a tone for his pontificate?
I think it set the tone from the very first night that he was elected. There is a story that people like to tell, a very true story, that when he finished his initial greeting on the balcony of the Basilica to the people of Rome, he showed himself to be a man who was very humble, not weak, but humble. And he addressed the people as their pastor. He said, my primary job is I'm the Bishop of Rome, and then Rome is the seat for the Roman Church internationally. He asked them all to bless him before he blessed them. And what we've learned over these couple years is that he really has found in his own life, his own, what sustains his spirit. People marvel that here's a man who's almost 80 years old, who only has one lung. Where does he get all this energy? You see him just energized, become energized when he's with people, and especially the poor. He left the balcony. They cleared everyone out because they said, now you may enter the elevator. And he looked around and he's like, well, why isn't anybody getting on? Oh, no, Holy Father, you ride it alone. He goes, he said, that's ridiculous. And he just started waving people into the elevator, gutting the minivan with everybody else, you know, that kind of. So there are these really charming stories that were not anything but authentic. He wants and does live a very simplified lifestyle for a bishop, let alone the Bishop of Rome. Mm. And in turn has repeatedly in his exhortations directly to bishops and then wider talks that he wants to be heard by priests and bishops, said, I want my my pastoral ministers, pastor in Latin simply means shepherd, I want my pastors to smell of the sheep. Mm. He himself, therefore, has made these efforts to, despite the restrictions now in his work because of his office, to have direct contact with people. A recent example this past week got a lot of news coverage, photo coverage. There was a special event to invite young people to the Sacrament of Penance to confess their sins, and he showed up for it for an hour, unannounced, and simply grabbed a folding chair and threw on a purple stole, which is a symbol of the sacrament, and heard as many young people as could come do their confession of sin to him in an hour, and then got back to work in the office.
Rode the minibus, I guess. there's a papal Jaguar, and the papal
there was
Mercedes?
Apparently some kind of a limousine. Yeah,
yeah, that was. But he chose.
He refuses. He has a Ford Focus.
Yeah, he has a Ford Focus. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. He doesn't want any of that. He actually, early in his first year, early in his papacy, he was slipping out and simply eating in restaurants in the neighborhood outside the Vatican, and just sort of surprising people. And at times, because he knew that priest seminarians would be eating in those places, these are neighborhood kind of, you know, right, pasta shops, and just wants to be that close. It seems he's not able to do that as much now, but when he was still a moving target, he would do these sorts of things, yeah.
Well, I'm sure the Vatican security people would be quite concerned about the Pope slipping out at night going into the streets. Isn't it true that since he has been Pope, we've observed a couple of Easter seasons, that on the Holy Thursday, that instead of doing the ceremonial washing of the feet at the Vatican, that he went to, I think this last Easter, he went to a youth reform or youth detention facility, yep. Washed not only the feet of young men who were in trouble with the law, but young women, mm-hmm. and maybe a couple of Muslims.
Yes, exactly. Yes, yeah. Washing the feet of young men and young women, Christian and Muslim. In previous years, he's also been either at prisons or at a refugee detention center, one of these years so far. And in all these cases has made a point, I do believe, yes, certainly Muslim people, almost each of those years. The first year, the fact that it was with, that he was washing women's feet at all, it's a very highly charged issue in many parts of the Catholic Church throughout the world, whether or not women's feet should be washed, or should it be 12 men, which symbolizes the 12 apostles, right, at the Last Supper. He actually has gone from that practice over these 3 or 4 years to, he did this year at Holy Thursday, make it now in the universal law of the Church that both women and men's feet could be washed. He was actually breaking the rule doing it up until this year, and then he simply changed the rule. And it's an important one because he's working in every way he can to show that every one of the baptized are members of the body of Christ, and that even the mystery of the Church, as the Second Vatican Council taught, the mystery of the Church is broader than not only the Roman Church, but even of Christianity, that God is working out God's love for humanity in the broadest circles we could imagine. And to get very petty and territorial about, well, are you a Catholic, or are you a man, or are you a woman? It sounds a lot more to me like St. Paul, huh? In Galatians, it's in Christ, neither slave nor free, right, male or female, Gentile or Jew.
That's where the word Catholic means universal.
Yes.
And not the idea is not limited to a certain brand or a certain logo over the church door.
Yes. I mean, there's certainly the way it's developed. Roman Catholicism, I think we can safely say, really comes into its existence as we know it now precisely because of the Protestant Reformation. So once what the Church is and who leads the Church becomes an utterly practical question with the Reformation, then the language of the Church being Catholic but Roman Catholic really comes into full force. And while there's a lot of local enculturation of the practice of Catholicism, which I find at the Divinity School at times in my courses surprises the students, they don't realize how much cultural variation there is in the Catholic Church throughout the world, even in practices and so forth. Nonetheless, it's unique in Christianity, the Roman Catholic Church, in that there's such a strong central government and a code of canon law, an international law code that's as thick as a phone book, which there, again, is there to protect and help people at its best, like any law system is, legal system.
But Father Morrill, in his latest big encyclical, runs many, many pages, Amoris Laetitiae, forgive the bad Latin, but
pretty darn good.
But basically the joy of love.
Yep.
If I understand it correctly, and I haven't read the whole document, I've read some commentaries on it, but he's saying, you know, we're not here to change canon law so much, but how my priests, how my church deals with people. Mm-hmm. Now, we're dealing with divorced people. We're dealing with LGBT people. Mm-hmm. We're dealing with people who have all kinds of wounds and insecurities and distress.
Parents.
Yeah, single parents. Is he saying basically that let's show the love of Christ and then we'll talk about the rule book later?
I think it's a both and. Although let's talk about the love of Christ. Yes, that has to be the priority, and that for any human social institution, that it would need laws to help govern and support both individuals and the common good. That's just a human phenomenon. It's not surprising. Mm-hmm. But then all of it has to be put in that perspective, even in this case where it's the church's effort to try to live also by the divine law and what Roman Catholicism calls the natural law, that it's not just that God has revealed extraordinarily God's self through revelation, but in Roman Catholicism, we trust also that just the way we've been created, you know, through this, God has communicated a lot of God's wisdom or the wisdom for us to tap. So when it comes to issues like the GLBTQ people or community of our own, it's very new to our postmodern times, not homosexuality, but this kind of living of it and identifying
the
it as society.
Aspect.
Yeah, absolutely. And really all of our dimensions of sexuality, even marriage itself, has changed radically, even in Western Europe, right? Arranged marriages were not unknown not so long ago. In parts of the world, they still are. A big part of the culture, parts of Africa, India, etc. So what he's doing in this document is not to deal with the law question so much as to deal with what is the fundamental attitude by which we, whether starting with the clergy, but all Catholics, and he says all people of goodwill, what is the fundamental attitude by which we are meeting the other person? He wants this to be about real lives, really listening and attentive to what he describes early on in the document as the, I'm paraphrasing a bit, but the messiness and the complexity of life. And as he's been interviewed about the document since it's come out a couple weeks ago, he keeps bringing this point up right away. You know, he said, life is very, very complex. And things like canon law and liturgical law, these should help, but you can't make them be a bludgeon. Kind of beaten down on people. With this, he's working off the Second Vatican Council, the reforming council of the Roman Church that was finished 50 years ago last fall in the 1960s, wherein both a dogmatic constitution on the church and a pastoral constitution, they're two separate long documents, really press this notion, including in the pastoral constitution an entire section explaining the concept of conscience, and how every human being is obligated to exercise his or her conscience, to inform it, to be well-informed, to discern, to gather information in one specific situation. But in this new document, he's reintroducing or reemphasizing that conscience figures in the real complex individual circumstances of people.
Is he saying that individual Christians need to be take more responsibility for their own spiritual condition? And does this say we're not really so reliant on the priesthood?
We should be relying on the priesthood as one of the ways in which we're constantly informing our conscience. We should be working with our local pastor. Pastors themselves should be getting ongoing education. But again, his emphasis is also pastors need to smell of the sheep, meaning they need to be eating with people, visiting people, learning about, in this document on the family, he highlights at the beginning the great social economic strains that all families are under, or largely families are under. And of course, he's thinking, especially the Southern Hemisphere, all these different problems. So yes, conscience is, the idea is, in one way we could put it in perhaps a more American register would be, he's calling on everyone to be mature. Don't succumb to the temptation at times. The temptation might be, in difficult circumstances, to feel like one could then just say, well, the church taught this and I feel oppressed by that, you know, it's not, I'm just messed up and I can't help it. It's much more important to say, who am I, how we in the church can help each other in the difficult situations.
It's just kind of acknowledging there can be and probably will be a crisis of conscience.
In almost any life, because as he's saying, our lives are complex.
Messy. Let me ask you this. Pope Francis was asked about one of the long-standing traditions in the Roman Catholic Church, and that's the celibacy of the clergy. What direction is he going in on this? And here again, in light of the fact that it seems like there are fewer and fewer young men willing to sign up for this lifetime assignment of being both celibate and being a priest and servant of the church.
Yes, exactly. And he did directly receive that question flying back from Brazil several summers ago when he was visiting there for a World Youth Day conference. Began his custom of having impromptu, but informal press conferences on the plane with the press, they asked him this question about a married clergy, because in Latin America, Brazil, which is one of the biggest countries, let alone in Catholic countries, and his answer was, these things need to be dealt with in the regional forum. This is not a question I want the Roman Church bureaucracy in Rome to mandate for the entire global church. He says, I want local bishops' conferences, which is each bishop's conference is comprised of the bishops of a given region or country. He goes, I would like them to deliberate about whether or not this is something they need.
So he has opened the door.
He's definitely, and he said, I'd be willing to receive from any bishops' conference their worked out plan and proposal if they wanted to have a married parish clergy. He has not to date, 3 years later, but he has said that, yeah. Mm-hmm. And there are many other aspects about church operation, et cetera, where he's repeatedly insisted he wants to give, again, almost this issue, if individuals should exercise their conscience and grow up and do that, likewise, bishops need not just to look at themselves as yes men to the Vatican, mm-hmm. be mature, read the signs of the times in your own situation, do the hard work of deliberating, you know, and arguing it out. See what you come up with, and I'll be happy to entertain it.
Speaking of yes men to the Vatican, he doesn't have all that many yes men. He's had some pushback because while many, many people have welcomed and embraced the new direction Pope Francis has taken, this seems to be almost an existential threat to some of them. In the Vatican, because the bureaucracy has kind of ossified in place with traditions that date back centuries, they're not so welcoming.
This is the word, yeah, from the Vatican and Vatican observers, that there are a lot of career bureaucrats in the Vatican, clerics, who are very unhappy with this papacy and very unhappy with him. And the problem there is, in such an internal and internally self-perpetuating system, you have people who acquire whatever is powerful in that little world, but they're the big fish in the small pond.
Right.
And yet, it's such an important one. I'm not going to try to keep pushing that analogy. And one of the things that really deflated and finally caused the resignation of his predecessor, Pope Benedict XVI, were the results of an internal investigation that he ordered, Pope Benedict XVI, of the Vatican bureaucracy and its finances. And when he received that report in December of 2012, the word is that he simply was overwhelmed by it. Mm-hmm. And he really went into his own discernment for a month or two about, do I have the physical strength? I'm 85 years old. Do I have the strength to do this, to lead this? And he decided he didn't. And that's one of the key reasons he resigned.
And that was surrounded with a lot of controversies, speculation on what caused Pope Benedict to call it quits. Practically unheard of. Not totally unprecedented.
But the precedents were so long ago and unique circumstances. Yeah. He was really pointing out also, and I found this to be a great move that he made. He said, look, we don't, the average age of a man now, and with medical care available and stuff, it's not like a pope dies in office when he's 68 or 71. You know, he was, here I am, I'm in my 80s, and this is a very complex job. And I don't know about you, but Bill, but I imagine myself, would I want that kind of a job in my 80s? He said, I'm going to retire. Bishops retire in the Roman Church. They're required to tender the resignation of the Pope at age 75. The Pope may not receive it and say, I'd like you to keep going, but it's a check-in time. Yeah. And he said, I want to resign. But that was one of the key reasons, it seems, that this
was just overwhelming. The reforms now.
And the reason they voted for someone outside of Europe, excuse me, too.
Yeah.
We've got to elect a Pope who's not within the system.
Not in the system.
Right. The social, economic, political system.
Well, you know, there's that big intersection between the church and Mammon's world and church finances, Vatican finance. I'm not talking about just the Vatican Bank, which has been widely accused of all kinds of fiscal crimes, including money laundering for drug cartels and things of this sort. I'm not here to make that accusation. It's been in the media. But financing, the financing of the church, the finances of the church, which, of course, in a lot of in a lot of places have been under stress, mainly with the settlements and the pedophilia cases. finances have been under stress. So what is he targeting here with the finances?
Well, with the finances, he's targeting what you've already mentioned, that the Vatican Bank itself it has to be completely reformed. But then also the financial operations of the major offices of the Vatican, which based out of a Latin word are called dicasteries, I think we'd call them offices. As I understand it, implications of financial ties, clandestine financial ties, again, in a bureaucracy that becomes and had become so insular, mm-hmm. it's the perfect breeding ground for corruption.
No accountability.
And, only mutually accountable. Mm-hmm. And when you think about it, the kind of men that are elected Pope, John Paul II, sadly, one of his weaknesses, they say, was that he did not concern himself with internal operations that much. He wanted mm-hmm. to let that be operated by different cardinals, et cetera, down the line. And, of course, in his pontificate, made over 70 or 75 international trips, this kind mm-hmm. of thing. Right. Well, there's a lot of internal trouble, a little running amok in there. Yeah. And that Benedict XVI was a professor. Like I said, I think he felt overwhelmed. So, yes, there's a lot to be done, and it's being done. He's brought in a Cardinal Archbishop from Australia who's just very acutely mm-hmm. sharp on this stuff. And again, typical in this pattern from his election, they elected a man. They said, we have to go outside of Europe. And likewise, the man he picked to lead up this internal reform on the financial front was a man from Australia, from outside of Europe. These are just very practical institutional moves. He's also set up a cabinet and has functioning for a couple of years now of 9 cardinals, making sure at least one from each continent who are advising him who are not in the system. So he's trying to bring in a lot of outside light, right? Just shine it on that.
Mm-hmm. We're in our second overtime, and so many mm-hmm. subjects, we've barely scratched the surface here. I wanted to talk to you about Pope Francis and the way he addresses the non-Roman Catholic world and the non-Christian world, but maybe we can kind of embrace that. What's going to have to be my last question? Mm-hmm. Your work, you are a practicing priest. You have pastoral duties at the Cathedral of the Incarnation Christ the King Church, and you also do a ministry at Riverbend Maximum Security Prison.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So as Pope Francis addresses the unchurched world, okay, this is basically what you're doing with the inmates, right? I mean, what?
Yes,
and
it's
try
true.
And get them reintegrated into society.
Yeah, that's very true. In what limited time I am able to give weekly, which is only an hour or two on weekends, I participate in an ecumenical group that's actually run by Church of Christ members from Lipscomb mm-hmm. University. I'm just humbled to be with them. But yes, and then we have a very small number of Catholics overall in the prison, but we do Mass with them and mm-hmm. some other Christians who come. Yeah, the work there really is one of genuinely of rehabilitation, correction, and reform, so that the prison is not a place that is just a penal colony and punishment and that sort of thing. There is a debt to society, but society is going to be the richer when every individual is healthy, mentally healthy, reformed, and for those who are able to be released, really integrated back into society. So that's certainly how I see it. It brings us back to that Jesuit principle I think I mentioned at the beginning, the service of faith and the promotion of justice. To say to someone, I want to help you love Jesus or Jesus loves you, but I really don't care whether or not you can get a job when you get out of here. That's a contradiction.
Mm. Let's say, hypothetically, you've devoted your life to academia, to service of the church, but let's say you were called in by the top policymakers and politicians. Let's say the governor, Haslam, called you. Said, Father Morrill, I want to talk to you, brought in the Speaker of the House, the Lieutenant Governor, the leadership of the legislature. And they said, Dr. Morrill, we're going to change our corrections policy in Tennessee, probably in pretty radical ways. What would you suggest we do?
Hmm. Well, there's both I would say in the wider society, the Ban the Box movement is something that we should...
Before you check if you're on
right.
a job application.
For now, it's required that one has to check whether or not one's been convicted of a felony.
Except in Davidson County.
The mayor has already moved on that. But I would say, first of all, what we can do in the wider society that way, within the prison system itself, interestingly, insofar as I'm a volunteer at the prison, I am technically treated as someone who is an employee. It simply is. We're warned of this. So I think have to pass on the question.
Oh, okay.
Can you imagine? But I think that's what I have to do.
Well, I understand that and certainly respect that. But I take a back seat to no one in my admiration for you and others who go into the prisons and go into the jails. And
thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Carry this message. I think that is wonderful. One last question, very quickly. The earlier encyclical, papal, the big elaborate letter on the environment, Christians and non-Christians having a duty to preserve, protect, not destroy the environment.
Yes. Yes, that came out last June. Yes, Laudato Si, the encyclical is named for the first line from a poem that St. Francis of Assisi in the Middle Ages wrote, praise to you, Lord, and he extols God in all the ways God is seen in creation. Francis put a lot of work into that very long document, integrating the state of the question, the consensus on the part of the scientific community globally, about the warming of the planet and the human exacerbation of the phenomenon, looking for what he calls an integral ecology, meaning we have to look at the ecological question in relation to economics and all the other factors of social life. He calls on all people of goodwill. He writes the document not just for Roman Catholics or Christians, but for everyone, and sees it again as a real situation that, while it's daunting to address, he's saying we can work on this question precisely, and in that work, discover so much of our own goodness and our own really engagement or co-creation with God and what God wants in the world. Yeah.
Excellent answer in a very short format. a lot to cover there. Father Morrill, thank you so much for taking this time to be with us. Dr. Bruce Morrill is the Molloy Chair Professor of Catholic Studies in the Divinity School at Vanderbilt University. Also, as I mentioned, still very active as a priest in presiding at communion and working in the prison population in Nashville. Thank you so much for being with us.
Bill, it's been my pleasure, and I've enjoyed my first visit to McMinnville.
Well, it's a beautiful afternoon as we sit here and record this. I don't know what the weather's going to be like when it's actually on the air, but a beautiful spring day, and hope you enjoy your drive back to Nashville. Thank you so much, and thanks to our listeners. You've been in tune with another edition of Focus, a locally produced, locally originated program in which we discuss subjects of timeliness and relevance in our community, and sometimes interpreting community rather broadly, sometimes globally. Thank you so much for being with us, and thanks for your support for Independent Public Radio in McMinnville. For WCPI and Focus, this is volunteer producer Bill Zechman.